Welcome to Vermont Favorites on WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM. I'm Adam Rabin. Each week, I talk with musicians, artists, performers, and creators about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. My guest today has taken his years of performing as a storyteller, comedian, actor, and magician to the classroom as a teaching artist throughout Vermont and at Tiger Monkey Dragon Performing Arts. And since he's from Milwaukee, we're going to find out who has better beer and cheese, Wisconsin or Vermont. Please welcome Vermont favorite, Mark Stein.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you can make it in.
Good to be here.
Yeah, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
How's winter over there
now? It's very similar to how winter is here. Punishing and long. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and dark and gray. Yeah.
You still have family back there?
Yeah, my parents are there.
Right on. Yeah. Are they dealing with single digit?
They're dealing with it the way that, you know, people in their 70s and 80s do, by like falling down a lot. Yeah, it's unnerving. Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So what brought you guys out to, how far back does your family go in Wisconsin?
Grandparents, and then great-grandparents were from, on one side, Lithuania, mm-hmm. Russia, and on the other side, Austria, mainly.
Okay, yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, you know, right. It's like, you know, Eastern European Jewish kind of World War II, let's get out of here kind of thing.
Yeah. My family came over probably about 100 plus years ago from Ukraine. They were similarly trying to not get killed.
Yeah, we actually have my great-grandmother's forged documents that she used to get out of Tsarist Russia.
Wow.
Yeah, falsified documents. I would love to know more about the story, but it's kind of lost in the mists of my family history.
A lot of things are.
Yeah.
Yeah, like our, you know, my family name is different than it was, and, you know, things change.
It's interesting because it was a time where cultural history was not something that people, you know, they valued but didn't value so assertively.
Well, when the option is preserving the family history and living.
Right.
You know, the family history by continuing it. Yeah. Right.
You get here and there's a certain amount of paranoia, I think.
You know? Yeah. So you grew up, I guess, in the 70s, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So, you know, Star Wars, like the first round and,
right.
You know, and all that. So, you know, Stretch Armstrong and you know, He-Man Masters of the, you know, like all those 70s TV shows.
We played with the same toys and stuff. I grew up outside Philly, but same cultural experience. You perform you started up a school for kids.
Yeah, a performing arts. I call it a performing arts community.
Gotcha.
You know, we have an improv troupe, but we do a lot of other things too.
How did your interest in performing arts start? I mean, just from the very beginning in Milwaukee.
I think I was always kind of a chatty kid and always kind of a ham, mm-hmm. You know, and dramatic play and stuff like that. But my first real crystallized memory is that I think I was like 8 or 9 and my Uncle Jay gave me a one of these cheesy magic kits.
Right.
And that was it. I was done. I was totally fascinated by magic and magicians. Soon after that, started performing at kids' birthday parties. And I have no idea how, but I also started performing a lot at we used to call them old age homes.
Right.
You know, like retirement homes and stuff like that.
And how old were you when you were doing these performances for?
9.
Nice.
Yeah.
Was it your parents? I mean, did they come from a performing background?
No.
Or are they just?
No. Look, my father is a trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. And is a performer by nature. I mean, he's really made his mark as a trial lawyer, really by being a good
showman.
A good showman,
and
a storyteller, and it runs in the family, And we're sort of a storytelling family, And then my dad was in like plays at the synagogue and stuff like that, and I always found that interesting. And certainly my parents encouraged me. That was mainly, really more than anything.
They encouraged.
More than anything, whatever I did, they encouraged.
That's great.
Yeah.
The encouragement, they don't need to be able to give you direction or education, but having the encouragement and the support is pretty much everything.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you get a kid with positive self-esteem and motivation, they'll go from there.
Right.
They don't,
Well, and Even beyond that, even the incredibly stupid things I did sort of like into my 20s, All right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, I would do, hey, I'm in Europe and I've decided instead of staying in hotels, I'm going to squat. Okay. That means sleeping in abandoned houses, right? Yeah. And they're like, wow, that's interesting. Okay.
And this is your parents being encouraging.
Yeah. Well, listen, when you come to your parents with something like that and they don't tell you, they don't tell you you are a crazy, insane moron, you know, right. Stop doing that. That's encouraging.
Well, they must. And it also shows a bit of trust.
They have shown a tremendous amount of trust in my notoriously faulty judgment.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that they have trusted that if things ever got truly dicey, I would understand and kind of.
Yeah. So you did. So you were over in Europe. Oh, yeah. Squatting.
Yeah. Squatting and street performing. Yeah. Yeah. A couple of times.
Magic? Were you doing like street magic?
I was performing magic on the street.
Yeah. Like whereabouts? Europe is.
I found myself in Amsterdam a lot.
How about that?
And also there was, you know, and the thing is, Amsterdam was fun, but it was a really rough town for street performers.
Yeah.
I even had a somewhat frightening mishap. I used to, you know, I had a kind of a standard classic magic routine, cards and coins and stuff. But I was pretty good at this 100-foot rope escape, where I would give someone 100 feet of rope and give someone else a stopwatch. You know, the trick is to get out in less time than it takes them to tie you up. And I had been doing this since I was a kid, and I considered myself really good at it. The hardest part is making it seem more difficult than it is.
The showmanship.
Absolutely, because often people do such a horrific job of tying you up that the ropes just fall right off. And
you have to make it look difficult.
So you know, and that was terrific until one day when I was having a really hard time getting people to stop and watch my show and came up with the brilliant idea of starting by getting someone random on the street to tie me up. And the spectacle of someone getting tied up would, you know, draw a crowd. And I was correct. Yeah. It drew a crowd of like 50 people watching me get tied up by someone who I'm convinced to this day that this guy was a farmer.
Okay.
And that he had a lot of experience tying up maybe, you know, like animals who were really not into being tied up, because this guy did a number on me like I've never even seen.
Wow.
And I wound up having to, and I don't, you know, I didn't have an assistant. I was working around by myself. So I actually.
If you got stuck, you got stuck.
I was stuck. Yeah. Like there was no getting out of these ropes. And I looked at this guy and I'm like, all right. You know, and the person with the stopwatch yells, time. You know, and from the back of the crowd, I hear an American female voice go, that's sad.
Oh.
And I look over at this guy and I'm like, all right, come and tie me up. And for about, I would say, a solid 3 seconds, which is a long time when you're tied up.
Yeah.
He gave me this look that said, you know, I really should leave you here. It led to some fascinating.
So that's not the kind of thing you tell your parents about, you know.
No, that's absolutely the kind of thing I tell my parents about. Yeah,
and they must have said, "Well, did you learn something?"
They said you're a moron. You know, their thing with stuff like that is, please tell us about that afterwards. You know, they would rather hear me say, you know, hey, I jumped out of a plane than I'm going to jump out of a plane.
Fair enough. Easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I wonder, because I do a lot of that too. Mm. And I don't wonder whether or not my students understand. I routinely call them knuckleheads and morons. And
that's they fascinating.
They get it. You know, they like it. I'm like, all right, come on. Moron number one. Getting moron number two. You know. And I don't worry about them because they understand that it's meant affectionately.
Yeah.
I sometimes wonder about people walking past areas where I'm teaching and
without
the context, it's really difficult to hear a teacher say, hey, listen, if you don't stop talking, I'm going to rip your arm out of the socket and beat you to death with it. So, you know, quiet down.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing, because I remember growing
people
up.
People just misunderstand. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Taken out of context. Right, I can understand. But yeah, I remember, you know, growing up in the 80s, there was that kind of loose repartee, if you will, with teachers. You know, because I went to public. Did you go to public school?
Yeah, I did.
Right.
Yeah.
So I had a little bit of that. I got called names by the teachers sometimes.
Yeah. Right.
And it's like it's there to toughen you up, or just out of just affection.
And you know, but I think that when you do that, you're also serving a really important pedagogical function.
Oh.
Well, for the following reason. You know, one of the things I say to my students a lot is one of your main jobs in life is to decide which version of yourself to be in any given situation, which version of me does this situation call for? And it requires a very kind of subtle reading of your surroundings and of people. And there's a big difference between me saying to someone in a good-natured way, hey, knucklehead, get over here.
Yeah.
And someone saying to me in the wake of a difficult moment in that person's life, you know, you are a knucklehead.
Right.
And, you know, developing an understanding of those subtleties,
I consider,
you know, it's like in the animal world. You know, you see, two animals engaging in rough and tumble play. Well, it's enjoyable.
Right.
And they're doing it because they're pursuing their enjoyment. But they're learning something very important about interacting with each other in the world.
Yeah.
I must tell you, I think that's one of the reasons why it's really unfortunate that schools have had to marginalize what teachers sometimes refer to as rough and tumble play.
Tell me more about that, because again, because we are about the same age, I remember a lot of rough. I mean, I got into fights outside
right.
of school.
Right.
And there was no, I barely ever even told my parents about it, let alone, you know, had to call,
right. You
know, police. And I mean, I can just imagine if there's a fight now, these days.
Oh, or there would on be the social playground. Workers and police. Yeah. And yeah, no. And, yeah. And you know, look, again, taken out of context, it's going to be like, oh, hey, Stein is advocating fighting.
Right.
But in a sense, I kind of am. Because even in sort of a shoving and punching conflict between two people who are having a challenge with each other, there are still far more rules in place than there are opportunities for truly anarchic behavior.
Rules in place in a fight, you mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even in an unmanaged conflict between two kids,
you know,
there is sometimes a moment where one kid looks at the other and goes, "What was that? What was that?"
Like, for example, what are you getting into?
If you go from shoving and punching to grabbing a handful of sand and chucking it in another kid's face,
that's another level,
right?
Yeah.
Then you have escalated in a way that is inappropriate to the situation, and in a way that I believe both kids kind of tacitly understood was in place.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even more so, I could see managing, mitigating, or even eliminating physical altercations between students or among students
right.
who are really having a tough time with each other. But when we also extend that to, you know, rough and tumble, even kind of violent-looking play,
right.
we remove this critical opportunity.
And it also exposes the students to, you know, even if they engage in a fight or, you know, something
right.
a little more rough than just rough and tumble play, you're exposing them to that difference between play and actual,
right.
you know, fighting, so that when they as grown-ups, i.e. you,
yeah.
or their parents see it, they
right.
say, oh, they're just screwing around.
Right.
They're not actually trying to hurt each other.
So this, to me, is the central essence of improv, especially improv comedy. Improvisational theater in general, but comedy even more so.
Hmm.
I think that improv comedy is a powerful enough tool for developing these skills that it can actually act as a surrogate for the types of play that I think are permanently marginalized in schools. Rough and tumble play, large amounts of unstructured time where, you know, kids have to sort of figure out, because improvisational comedy is about understanding a limited set of rules and parameters before we start.
Mm-hmm.
With the understanding that we're going to be mutually agreeing on an additional set of rules and parameters as we go, and that because of the situation we're in, we can't explicitly discuss them.
Good point. That's an important thing that you tailed, you know, that you put at the end there, that we can't talk about it in the middle of it.
Right.
You can't, right, because
and just
performing.
Just like, you know, for example, in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
There are sometimes opportunities to stop and say, hey, can you and I debrief about an interesting or difficult or important interaction that we had? But most of the time we can't.
Right.
Most of the time we're too embroiled in our work day and the social, emotional and work structures that surround us. And you and I just have to come up with that stuff on the fly. I think I think a lot of this a lot of what's coming out about just the horrific and despicable behavior of specifically men in power in workplaces.
Sure.
I think a lot of what's coming out now we're seeing the result of people who grew up without the opportunity to really explore the idea of boundaries. Mm. You absolutely can't find a boundary until you smash into it.
It's true.
You know?
Well, the irony is that some of the people that we're talking about here are in the performing arts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and, yeah. and some of them, I'm not going to start mentioning names,
right.
but they're really good.
Yeah, it's and exactly.
At entertaining and yeah. performing arts and yeah. comedy.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you got to wonder, where was that gap? And
I think the gap occurred very specifically in childhood in the types of play that these kids engaged in. I would go you one better. I think that these people are not only talented and committed to their art, I bet just about all of these people are decent, wonderful people with just a really tragic misunderstanding of themselves and their place in the world and an inability to understand and empathize with, you know, the feelings of other people. Well, if, you know, unless I've had this repeated experience of running out onto the playground and like pounding my friends and getting pounded by my friends and then needing a moment where I go, wait, like, I'm sorry, you've crossed a line here with me. Or having someone say to me, wait, you've crossed a line here with me. You know, I just have an atrophied ability to do that in social situations. You know, when pursuing your own enjoyment rises to the top of the list, you don't really have a prayer.
No, and there's that it's incongruous to for a lot of these people who, because you can tell they lead a perfectly normal, healthy, and successful life, but there's this little piece that, you know, they didn't show up that day.
Right.
You know, they missed that day of school.
And this is, by the way, absolutely not to minimize the terrible damage that these people do. It doesn't mitigate their responsibility.
No, it's explaining it. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's really, I mean, it's interesting. It's so difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, but when I'm with my, especially with my improv students, you know, that's really the core.
And these are kids, these are young kids. What age range are you talking?
My youngest are usually around third graders, and kids have stuck with me straight into high school.
All right. Those are the perfect years where they're learning about their boundaries.
Right.
And as they relate to other people. And especially because you mentioned through high school, because that's like that middle school time is puberty. That's when you're figuring out what all this whole sex, how it sex plays into your daily life.
Yeah. And it's when the need to more specifically define other people makes itself felt to you.
Interesting. Defining other people, because one of the key tenets of improv is, you know, defining yourself and creating a world as you go.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, tell me more about how you think the individual improv theater, I mean, doesn't it necessarily need to be comedy, but, you know, the theater skills can open up minds at that age.
Well, you know, but I think that there's something particularly valuable about comedy in the world of improv. Comedy gives you the quickest feedback to whether or not you're succeeding. It's very goal-oriented. Right. You are looking for something funny.
Right.
And everyone in the room knows when you've found it.
You don't wait till the end of the play to laugh.
Does this feel real to me? Well, either you laughed or you didn't.
Right. Whereas in drama, you wait till the end of the play and then you go
pause. And you know, maybe it achieved, you know, who knows what you were trying to accomplish. So, middle schoolers specifically begin, you know, you do it before this and you do it after it, but you really begin this activity of defining other people around you. And, you know, it's a normal and healthy activity and something that allows us to, you know, pursue the life that we need to. But as we all know, this can develop into a very harmful mental tendency.
Right.
Right.
Stereotyping.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you're doing improv comedy, you do a little bit of both, right? There's this notion of gifting.
Yes.
So I'm going to say, oh God, did you just use that superpower of yours on me?
Right.
Well, now I've provided you with the opportunity to define yourself in a really interesting way.
Yes.
Right. And so I've partially defined you, but I've left the door open to you adding to that definition. And because I'm a comedy improviser, anything you say, I'm going to respond to with yes, and I'm going to acknowledge the truth of what you say. And then I'm going to hopefully build on that. Yeah. Right. So when you get used to this rhythm of I'm offering something, you're accepting it and adding to it, this is a pattern that can lead to successful interactions in any sphere of human existence. And I stand by this 100%.
Yeah.
I think everyone should do improv comedy at some point in their life. You know, the other really important aspect of it is in improv comedy with a group, the comedy very specifically derives from the interactions of everyone on stage and not from the actions of any one person.
Right. Not just what the person says, but just as much how the other people respond to it and what it means to them and their characters.
And even beyond that, I and the other improvisers on stage are going to collaborate to create a realistic enough scenario that things that deviate from the pattern that we've established now have the effect of being funny. Mm. And what's amazing to me is my student improvisers are just that nerdy about their comedy. They are really interested in the theory aspect of comedy only because they've seen theory applied and turn into comedy.
What do you mean by theory? What theories are we talking?
The overarching structures that we apply to interactions of performers on stage. I'll give you a very basic example. An important rule of improv comedy is don't make the scene about someone who's not on stage, right? Mm-hmm. Don't spend a lot of time talking to or about people who are off stage. So I'll have, you know, students doing a scene and something is not working and it's really not funny, and we'll pause it and I'll say, all right, let's talk about this scene. What's going on here? And someone will inevitably pipe up with the right answer and will say, well, the scene's about someone who's not on the scene, in the scene. Right. Oh, yeah, okay, this is a rule that we tend to follow in improv. Let's apply this rule to this scene. See if you two guys on stage can gradually turn the scene towards yourselves and your relationship and away from... And all of a sudden, the comedy just appears magically out of nowhere.
Hmm.
And you know, watching theory applied and turn into a reality on the stage that produces something as elusive and challenging to find as humor.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. Humor is it's hard to define.
Yeah.
It's sometimes hard to arrive at. It's incredibly difficult to write things that are funny, and yet when it shows up, you always know it's there.
It's undeniable.
Yeah. And that is true cross culturally.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the very few things where across culture, gender, age, you know, history, background, economics.
It is something, it's a natural attraction.
Well,
because no matter who you are, everyone, again, it's tough to define what humor is, but everyone's working toward it.
Well, and the physiologically, the only two expressions, and I'm pretty sure that nothing has ever contradicted this research. There's a lot of very solid research about this. There are two facial expressions that are universal.
Right.
And that is mirth and horror.
Hmm.
People all over the world who are finding something funny
will laugh.
Generally look the same. They're, you know, a squinty-eyed, you know, smile-mouthed, you know, right, compression of the facial muscles that's indistinguishable from anything else. And people who are horrified by something, you can look at a Kalahari Bushman finding something horrified. And you know, some like Irish dude from Dublin will look and go, yeah, that guy's looking at something horrifying.
But something like, you know, general sadness or disappointment or happiness, there's different ways for that to come out.
The subtleties
there's
are
more
incredible.
Thinking between the feeling and the physical action. There's more steps in the brain.
Yeah, and more socialization around what constitutes, for example, something sad. You know,
there's more baggage with those.
There's a lot of baggage, and so when you're doing, again, when I'm working with students in the context of learning improv comedy, it doesn't matter who the kid is. When we succeed in making funny, funny is made, and it's in the room, and we all know it.
Maybe you should also look into improv horror.
This is why I love these conversations, because right. because on Tuesday when I am yeah. meeting with the Tiger Monkey Dragon Performing Arts Improv Troupe,
yep.
we're gonna hit that.
Awesome.
I'm gonna say to them, okay, we've done improv comedy. Let's see if we can improvise non-comedic horror for just a couple of moments.
Yeah.
You know,
if it, yeah, it's going to be universal, like you said, right?
Very interesting, right? Exactly.
Let me know how that goes. Report yeah. back.
I'm imagining badly, but it's you know there will be value to it. You know,
yeah. There's yeah. well, you still got to set down those rules. I'm just kind of thinking off the extemporaneously. How would you go about setting up an improv horror?
Oh, the rules I think would be identical.
Okay.
I think the rules would be exactly the same. For example, yes and, right?
Yeah.
Are those cat brains on your plate? Yes. Yes, and they're your dinner, yeah. right?
And it's your cat.
And it's your, right, you see, there you go. Yes, and it's your cat, right? Exactly. Right. See, it. You follow these rules, they yeah. take you where you're going. Yeah.
Inevitably. You were telling me before we got on the air about your class. First of all, I got to ask you about Tiger Monkey Dragon, the name of your performing arts. What would you call it? Performing arts school?
Tiger Monkey Dragon Performing Arts.
Okay,
there you go. I leave it there.
Yeah.
You know, and actually it was interesting because deciding on what that last word was going to be, mm-hmm. I decided to go for just maximum ambiguity to allow myself as much wiggle room as I can get.
Performing arts. Great. Yeah, it could branch out into any number of things.
We just did 3 days of animation. You know?
I saw photos on Facebook of that. That's yep, great. I
pulled in my cinematographer.
Yeah.
And we did 9 hours of animation with third graders through high school.
To make 3 seconds of film.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And actually, that leads to the name of the group. My cinematographer, a young guy named Paul, who's a tremendously talented young man, is a former student of my wife who mm-hmm. teaches film studies at UVM.
Oh, wow.
So Tiger Monkey Dragon Performing Arts, just from Zodiac, you know, Eastern Zodiac.
Oh, okay.
My wife is a tiger.
Okay.
I am a monkey, which incidentally, according to just about every reading of the Zodiac, is the worst possible combination
yeah.
for two people, a tiger and a monkey.
All right.
So we've got that going for us, which is good.
Yep.
Tiger, and I think dragons are awesome.
Dragons are
just
cool.
And so we were just walking around. Yeah. Yeah, we were walking around in Seoul, and I was planning on sort of formalizing the informal improv teaching that I'd done for a long time. And just kind of the name and the logo just kind of fell from heaven and
yeah.
fully formed in my head. Tiger Monkey Dragon Performing Arts.
What's a funny side note? You're talking about the logo. I had Patrick Tracy in here.
Oh, really?
A couple weeks ago.
The guy who designed me.
He designed your logo.
He is, you know, that guy is a tremendously talented artist because yep. I told him was, you know, the monkey with its arm around the tiger and the tiger and then but I also gave him, you know who hates me? Bartenders, right? Because I can't just say, give me a martini. I say, you know, I'd like sort of a smoky winter cocktail that features a bourbon, but with a tinge of sweet, you know. So, yeah. I didn't just say to Patrick, like, oh, design me a logo because I'm too high strung and controlling for that. So I said, well, you know, I want the monkey to be looking at the tiger in a way that's sort of mischievous, but also affectionate. I'd like the tiger looking out at us, the viewer, yep. in a way that is a little bit remote and menacing, but a little bit paternal. And I want this dragon in the background to be looking like it's sort of beating up this sort of elemental. And Patrick Tracy is like, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, sure. You know, and came to me with two drafts. And by the third draft, I'm like, wow, man.
That's great that he picked up on it despite, well, sometimes all that direction is good. I was just thinking about what you were talking about with the openness that you need to keep in improv
yeah.
performing.
Yeah.
And how you don't want to box your partner
right.
into a tiny corner.
Although sometimes in an improv scene, that can be fun. You yeah. need a huge, you know, you can do that if you develop a huge amount of trust
yeah.
with the people you're on stage with.
You got to work up to that.
And the students that I have right now, some of these guys have been playing with each other, you know, playing improv together yeah. for, you know, 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're actually at an incredible point as a troop, because they can actually see that coming now. I have one young man who loves to do that. Yeah. He loves to box another player into a tight corner. But
there's almost a fight aspect to that. Oh, right? They're
fully,
challenging.
Not almost. There fully is a fight aspect.
Yeah,
to
it's
it.
Like you're this, and this. Okay, get yourself out of
now
that.
Now go
it's,
for
it's
it.
It's the same as, okay, I've put you in a full Nelson. Right. Can you get out of it?
Yeah. And, you know, a full Nelson is uncomfortable if it's a, you know, if it's a bona fide antagonist that you don't know who's right. put you in a full Nelson, then you feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to do, when I was in New York, I used to fight a lot. I used to be in a jiu-jitsu dojo.
Okay.
And I did a lot of ground fighting. And I'm a particularly bad fighter.
Okay.
I have no talent at all as a fighter. But I sure did enjoy it. And I was pretty scrappy. And I never won, but I was hard to beat. And I think that a managed fight is one of the most beautiful interactions that you can be in. You know, we're struggling against each other. You want to win, I want to win, but we're struggling towards the exact same precise goal, and we're collaborators in it. And unless you and I collaborate completely, there's no way that you and I can have this fight.
That's true. Again, there's that set of rules that are understood.
It's going to sound very bizarre, but being sort of like, you know, being choked out and smothered by someone who you trust completely is a life-changing experience. It allows you to struggle against overwhelming circumstances, even panic-inducing circumstances, but in a completely safe context.
That's true.
This is the essence and the only reason why I do what I do.
It's learning how to fight. Learning how to fight responsibly.
Life is a struggle.
I thought it was fitting, and I know there's some poetry to the fact that Tiger Monkey Dragon is using dojos.
Yeah.
Right? That you're working out of a Aikido.
Yeah, and Aikido is one of the spaces we work out of.
Yeah.
And I also work out of North End Studios, and I adore North End Studios. Mm-hmm. They're wonderful people who have been terrific to me, and I intend to stay with them. But I love working out of a martial arts dojo. I take a martial arts perspective on the things that we're doing. My students completely go along for the ride. And also, you know, when we're in a dojo, there are mats on the floor and we can throw each other around a lot.
That's true. Yeah, because sometimes comedy can get physical.
And when we also teach hip-hop dance. And so the hip-hop classes are much better in, you know, with the mats under them. You know, my students are pretty athletic, and some of them are really like to roll around.
Yeah, but it can get dicey.
I personally do. I do not teach, by the way. I don't teach the cinematography. I also don't teach. I have a couple of kids that I hired. One of them is this nice young man named Dakota, who is actually a graduate of the school that I worked at for 7 years, at the schoolhouse in South Burlington, which is, again, another place that's very close to my heart.
Yeah.
And he comes in and teaches hip-hop for me.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very great cultural bridge to be bringing that kind of thing in.
Yeah.
You were telling me, I wanted to ask you about this. You told me a little earlier before we went on, the student makeup that you have right now, you're saying is mostly boys?
It's overwhelmingly boys.
Why do you suppose that is?
You know, I have my theories. Yeah. I have a couple of young women in my troop, and a few more, hopefully, who are in the process of joining up. I think that despite making some progress in this area, I think we still have a long way to go. And I think we encourage boys to be, you know, expressive and active. And despite our best intentions, I do think we encourage young women to be demure, acquiescent, responsive.
Right, not proactive.
Instead of proactive. Yeah. And I think that it sets up in us as adults expectations that we don't realize we have that children respond to.
Yeah, I'm noticing that a lot more. This year, I mean, just all what we were talking about earlier, just a lot of the, you know, the people in power, men,
yeah,
abusing that power and continuing that imbalance.
I think that acceptance, true acceptance of these realities, is going to lead to some perhaps very painful realizations, many of them among teachers of young children. I think that we, as teachers, without realizing it, behave very differently towards boys than we do towards girls. For example, personal space. I think that we as teachers tend to... I think we give girls the message that they have to be more accepting of encroachments onto their personal space and have less of a right to be assertive about defining what their personal space is. I think we give boys, after a certain age, after, say, age 4 or 5,
yeah,
I think we tend to give boys a little bit more of a respectful distance or a little more care in our approach in terms of... physical contact, hovering over, right?
You're saying you do that more for
boys. I think we give a little bit more distance and forbearance to boys, and that we, without meaning to, and this is not an indictment of teachers or teacher culture, but that we have more of a tendency to sort of walk up and put our arms around girls or, you know, hug girls.
Right.
And those are wonderful things. And I think physical contact is terrific. But I think after a certain point in a child's life, you have to model for them that they have the right to monitor proximity with people.
Right.
And so you do things like saying, you know, hey, I'm, you know, I find myself like putting my arm around you. Is that cool with you? Like, is that something you're cool with? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't just allowing me to do that once doesn't mean that you always have to let me do that. I think that, you know, through just sort of unspoken channels, we provide a very different message to boys than we do to girls. You know, we've sort of stumbled onto this very, you know, onto a really complex issue of sort of, you know, issues of gender and gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
And behavior and conformity. And I do see it playing out sort of in the various arts contexts that I find myself in. And it really raises many more questions than it provides answers. I was an improv comedian with Vermont Comedy Club for years. Back when they were Spark Arts, I was with Nathan and Natalie.
Yeah.
And then I was on one of the house teams at the comedy club for a while. And even in a, you know, it's hard to imagine a more welcoming, egalitarian, kind of, you know, assertively egalitarian or welcome and opening place than Vermont Comedy Club. And yet still, we see more men than women on stage. And mm-hmm. and I think it's really helpful to, you know, to kind of eliminate this gender binary.
Yeah.
And to understand things more on a spectrum, and I think it might loosen up some of these biases and tendencies. But I think it's a 100-year project.
It is several generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen a lot of steps taken recently. You know, since in the last, let's say, 50 plus years.
Yeah.
You know, from the 60s, from the women's movement then, and little bit by little bit. But yeah, there's still. We can never spend too much time patting ourselves on the back.
No.
Because you spend 2 seconds doing that and you're going to let something go by you that you don't realize.
Yeah. You know, the one young woman on my troupe who I feel is just an absolute paragon of sort of healthy, self-guided development.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that this young woman's mother has spent, you know, a lot of time talking about these things with her children, and that, you know, this young woman's ability to be kind of assertive and self-aware, you know, it is a long road.
Yeah.
And you know, look, schools are tough.
Believe me, that hasn't changed for any, you know, boys or girls.
Schools are just tough.
Yeah.
The best school is a tough place.
Yeah. When you started up, I was reading on your website, on the Tiger Monkey Dragon website, that you developed the school, the performing arts program, in collaboration with the parents.
Yeah.
What was that process like that, you know, you didn't just come up with it on your own, but you actually talked to the parents of the kids that you would be potentially teaching?
It was sort of an ongoing thing that evolved organically from my work at the schoolhouse, because I started just teaching drop-in improv classes mm-hmm. after school to anyone who wanted to come, parents, kids, whatever.
Oh, okay.
And as I started formalizing it, as I moved the program away from the schoolhouse and I started, you know, charging tuition and putting a little more time and effort into it, you know, these were parents with whom I'd had terrific dialogue for years. Yeah. So these conversations were really easy to have. What were you looking for your kids? What works? What doesn't seem to work? You know, one thing that I don't have my own kids. Yeah. And so one factor that I never really thought about was just how incredibly complex it is scheduling everything that their families need to do. And I find that they need sensitivity and compassion around scheduling requirements more than any other thing. Huh. And so conversations like that became very important.
Yeah, there's a lot of day-to-day stuff that we don't think about, not having kids.
Yeah, and once you start, you know, involving money and charging tuition, you know, they're sensitive topics. But mm-hmm. I've been very, very lucky. You know, the years that I spent at the schoolhouse put me in contact with some of the most incredible parents that I could ever imagine. And these are people who I still get to work with now.
Yeah. So they're still involved. And you don't just teach improv comedy. You do magic and stagecraft.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and some of these endeavors we're just launching now. The filmmaking is a new thing for us. Mm-hmm. And I'm training up a couple of magicians. The foundation is improv. We are working our way towards a show on a slightly different scale than we do now.
Oh, do tell.
Well, you know, it's a work in project. Right now we do small, you know, like sort of recital style shows.
Gotcha.
But I'd love to pull everything together and have one kind of vaudeville style show. Hmm. So, you know, coming probably next Christmas to a stage near you.
North End Studios is great for that.
Yeah, the Off Center, and there's a lot of places.
And you also do some storytelling.
Yeah.
You've done, I guess you teach it as part of Tiger Monkey Dragon, but you've also done it some yourself.
Quite a bit, actually.
With, what's it called, Extempo?
Yep. So Extempo is in central Vermont, and that's Lovejoy Dole.
Okay.
She is like ourselves, a person mm-hmm. who, you know, is out in the world earning a living, but also is very committed to the arts. Mm-hmm. And she's been running this, I don't know how many years, this event called Extempo. And yeah, it's, you know, getting up and telling stories. And then there's also Storytelling Vermont, which is Jin Ferrara. They do their show these days over at the Lamp Shop, you know, in Burlington.
Radio Bean, yeah.
Yeah, and that's another, you know.
So how did you get involved in that? What drew you to, you know, not prepared drama and not comedy, but, you know, storytelling will have humor to it, but it has a different purpose.
You know,
it has a different goal.
I'm a Jew. we
tell stories.
We're a naturally storytelling people, you know. But we, you know, then you know, like you go to one of these things and you meet someone, and they're like, "Oh, I'm Italian. We tell a lot of stories." You know, I'm a human being. We tell stories. I've always been a storyteller, and I've always been a lover of stories. And then I got here, and just someone I knew cued me into the fact that these events exist. I had no idea that this even existed as a thing that people did. You know, I'd seen The Moth, but, you know, that's a very kind of...
Big league,
yeah. It's very managed by The Moth. You know, it's very carefully curated, whereas the events that I go to, I mean, it's wide open.
Yeah. It's neat. And Central Vermont has its own special vibe to it.
It really, you know something? A lot of these events are in Barrie.
Huh.
And
you wouldn't think that... You know, Barrie is like the arts hub.
What is the name? There's this cafe in Barrie that we do these things at. I'm kicking myself.
Is it the little one?
Yeah.
Hang on.
Gorgeous. There's this gorgeous little cafe.
Espresso Bueno?
Espresso Bueno. Espresso. There you go.
I won a trivia contest. Their trivia contest like a year or so ago, and I still have the gift certificate in my wallet.
You know what? I started going to that place because they Lovejoy was holding these storytelling events there.
Right.
And I'm looking around. I'm like, Barry, huh?
Yeah.
Listen, if you're listening to this and you have not gone to Barry just to hang out, like, it's really a pretty cool place.
It's like you were saying, as long as you're human, you've probably got a story to tell.
Oh.
Whether you're in central Vermont or you just came over on a boat. And
yeah.
Exactly.
And really consider, you know, what I would say is if it's something that's interesting to you,
mm-hmm.
start by finding your like 10-second story. Oh, one time the following happened.
Yeah.
The one thing that you can say to someone that'll make their eyebrows rise, that they'll, oh, really?
Yeah.
Turn that into your 7 minutes and get on stage and do it.
Huh. It'll
change your life.
What did it do for you? Where did it take you? Or how did you get drawn in, I should say?
I think my journey will be a lot different from a lot of people's. You know, for me, I came at it from the perspective really of a performing artist and wanted to do an excellent job on stage, and then found that it really was also very emotionally cathartic. Not even necessarily because the story was so emotionally fraught, but because I stood on stage in front of an absolutely silent room full of people eager to hear what I had to say.
Because you did it,
made
it important.
Yeah, and I think a lot of other people will come at it maybe from the opposite direction, where they get on stage and because they have something emotionally powerful and relevant or very funny or interesting that they want to talk about, and then find through doing that, like, wow, I actually kind of nailed that. That was an interesting moment as a performing artist. Yeah. Maybe I'd like to do a little performing. I would
imagine it's a fairly even split. I mean, there's some people that, they want to just perform for the sake of performing, and then they find the deeper meaning in it.
Well, and, you know, my favorite is I occasionally, for Storytelling Vermont, get to actually MC these events.
Oh, fun.
And you're in a really interesting position because then, in addition to getting to tell a story, which is fun, you're kind of the person whose responsibility is to make it all okay.
Which goes back to our initial point from the beginning of the hour when we were talking about getting that encouragement.
Yeah.
Even if, you're in Europe squatting, but okay, that's okay.
All right, it's okay. Right.
It's okay.
You're getting up on stage and you're talking about something incredibly embarrassing about yourself and you're saying a lot. That's, don't worry, we're barely hearing the ums. You know, we're here for you.
Gotcha. Yeah? That's a great way to round out this part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I want to move on to the to the lightning round.
Sure.
Which doesn't have to go all that quickly.
Oh, hey, listen. Okay.
Which is the tell me about your favorite things about Vermont.
Oh, sure.
So tell me about your favorite Vermonter.
My favorite Vermonter. Oh, you're right. I remember. It's funny. I remember answering this one and thinking this is a cop out. This answer is a cop out. But I don't have necessarily, apart from my lovely wife, a favorite Vermonter.
Good answer.
But true. But my favorite type of Vermonter is, you know, I find myself running, and I'm incredibly chatty, and I talk to everyone, and I'm intimidated by exactly no one. So I find myself often talking to Vermonters, whether native or transplant, who really defy what I might have thought of that person from a stereotypical understanding of their appearance. You know, you meet the dude in coveralls with the chainsaw who's really well read.
Right.
You know, or who does, you know, or you know, or who is also a watercolorist, you know, or I remember, you know, I one time I rolled up, I was riding my motorcycle around for the day, just spending the day riding, and I pulled up to some country store out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I jump off the bike, you know, and strip off my riding jacket and I walk in, and the, you know, silver haired, rather prim looking, you know, elderly lady behind the counter, you know, is psyched to talk about my tattoos and wants to know what kind of bike I ride,
You know. And you're skipping over the fact that a performing arts Jew just got off a motorcycle.
Right, exactly. So we all come here to be, you know, totally iconoclastic. I find it's very refreshing, the number of people I meet here who kind of defy what I might have stereotypically thought about that person.
Wonderful. Well, tell me about your good answer. I'll accept that answer. Tell me about your favorite Vermont place.
There are two that leap to mind right away. One is just the roads in general here are so gorgeous.
Yeah.
These, you know, little state routes that, you know, and I kind of have a sarcastic attitude towards Vermont. You know, I'm driving around riding my motorcycle and I come around a bend and I'm like, oh, of course, Vermont.
It's going to be gorgeous.
A beautiful bucolic little field with a charmingly dilapidated barn. Yeah, okay. And the sun is going down behind the mountains. Thanks, Vermont.
I'll go around the next corner. Yeah. And hey, what's there?
Look, right. Oh, more. Oh, some cows. And they're like beautiful. You know, so the roads. And all the state parks that they lead to. And I really think my other favorite place in Vermont is Bread and Butter Farm in South Burlington.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's a place that I kind of discovered rolling past, and wandered into and have been lucky enough to kind of collaborate with in my work at the schoolhouse.
Nice.
And it's, you know, it's more than a farm. It's like a teaching farm and a community resource and just an incredible place where all of these dynamic things happen. I think that probably farmers and teachers are on the top of my list as the most important people anywhere. And they're both.
Yeah.
And man, those are some happy cows.
Nice.
At that farm. And boy, that is some tasty spinach. Like, you taste the love.
I get it.
And I think the things they're doing are courageous and fantastic.
That's a great answer. Yeah. Bread and Butter Farm. All right.
Yeah.
Tell me about your favorite Vermont memory.
One of my favorite Vermont memories is right after I got here. I sometimes call Winooski the Ellis Island of Vermont. You know,
the Ellis Island.
You know, you come from somewhere far away and you land in Winooski, you know. And then from there you filter out into the rest of the state. So
gotcha.
I moved to Vermont and I was living in Winooski and it was my fourth day here or something. I walked down and I went into Sneakers and I was eating breakfast by myself, and there was a gentleman at the next table, and we struck up a conversation. Yeah. And, you know, our tables were right next. We were basically sitting at the same table.
Yeah.
And at the end of the meal, you know, I talked about the fact that I had just moved to Vermont a short while ago, and he was a native Vermonter. And at the end of the meal, he told the waitress, okay, I'm gonna pay for everything. And I gave him my New Yorker's panicked look. You know, like my paranoid look of, oh,
what
God.
What do you want?
What do you want?
What's the scam here?
And it's so funny because he didn't even register it. Or if he did, he knew it was coming. And he said, listen, don't worry. It's not like a weird thing.
That's a very Vermont answer. Acknowledging the weirdness, but just saying, don't
exactly.
Worry about
it. And he gave me a little lesson on Vermont at that moment. He's like, don't worry. It's not a weird thing. It's a Vermont thing. Not that everyone's going to buy you breakfast, but that... Yeah. We tend to let people do their thing. And if we interact, it's, you know, I really am just welcoming you to the state and it's going to totally end here.
There's a pride in Vermont, you know, a state pride that not all states have. In fact, very few.
It's one of the things that I love about Vermont is this kind of place pride. The only place, I'll tell you what, you know, I've traveled quite a lot. The only other place I've seen anything quite like it, in a way that didn't kind of bug me, was in Australia. Australians love being Australian.
I get it.
They think being Australian is awesome. You know, I come from Wisconsin. You go to certain places in Wisconsin and there's this really incredibly terrifying identification with the place that they live that really you want to get away from as quickly as possible. Yeah. Not to smash and slam Wisconsin, but there are little pockets of like, whoa, you're like really into being from Tigerton. Like, whoa, dude.
Gotcha.
You know?
Well, that leads us to the final thing that I ask everybody. Is about their favorite Vermont food and or drink.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I tease this at the top of the hour, is Vermont and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk cheese and beer.
Right, I grew up in Wisconsin and strong associations with both cheese and beer. Now, I will say that Wisconsin has sort of, has developed a few interesting artisanal beers. Some of them vary. There's a couple in Milwaukee right now.
Yeah.
But it's really in kind of a Vermont idiom. You know, I moved to Vermont and found that there is better cheese and better beer here than I've ever encountered in Wisconsin.
Well,
in my
home
state.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
The Vermont idiom, you mentioned that about Wisconsin beer. First of all, I'm fascinated that you think there is a Vermont idiom.
But it's specifically with these couple of small breweries in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. There's a brewery in Milwaukee that reminds me a lot of The Alchemist, you know, in like, you know, when they were still had their shop in Waterbury.
Gotcha.
You know, taking just a huge amount of care and pride in a small artisanal product. Mm-hmm. But Wisconsin really with cheese and beer is more about quantity than quality.
I was going to say, because when it comes to beer and you think Milwaukee, you think about the big breweries, like the big mega breweries.
Yeah.
And then about cheese, we don't have cheese heads here in Vermont.
Right.
We're too busy making good cheese.
Right, yeah, right, exactly. So the best cheese in Wisconsin turns out to be the foam rubber cheese that Wisconsin sports maniacs wear on their heads. Yes, because the affectionate name for a Wisconsin sports enthusiast, I think specifically a Packers fan.
Yeah.
Right. Is it cheesehead?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're asking the wrong two people.
Yeah,
details.
Yeah.
I just think it's sad that we're doing this on a community radio station that can't reach, because it'll be streaming online. But it's a shame that we can't penetrate the airwaves of
just
Milwaukee.
Milwaukee market so that I get thousands and thousands of words of internet hate mail about my bad mouthing Wisconsin cheese. I remember when I was a kid, we would drive up north to some tourist place in Wisconsin, and we would always pass this place called the Mars Cheese Castle. It was a sign. It must have been a 50-foot tall, 30-foot wide sign, like one of these gigantic highway signs, and in enormous illuminated letters, it said Mars Cheese Castle. And you know
what on earth is this?
I don't live with a lot of regret, but we never stopped and looked around inside of the Mars Cheese, and maybe it's beneficial because now I'm left with this image of a Gothic castle rendered in cheese. Archways and domes, all rendered in cheese. But, and maybe a moat of like nacho cheese or something. I think with that in my head, it probably the Mars Cheese Castle would have been a big disappointment. And I'm glad we didn't go. So I'm really glad you helped me process this, Adam.
I processed your cheese
for
you.
Right, thank you. Yeah, well done. Well done. Yes, and.
The other pun I had in my back pocket was that, like, I'm just picturing this moldy old castle. But maybe in that case, it would work. Having all that mold.
Right, exactly. It would be in case the mice finally attacked. That could be the fortification. This is getting absurd.
Yeah, well, mice living in the walls of a cheese castle would be like heaven for them.
I suppose.
You don't have to worry about termites. You have to worry about mice.
Right, metaphor for societal ruin. Oh, those guys are the mice in my cheese castle.
That's a popular...
That's where that expression comes from.
That's where that expression comes from. But you only hear that expression in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, let me make an abrupt segue into the end of the show.
Sure, yeah. I think you're going to have to.
I think abrupt
is the only segue you can make from this point.
How can people find out about what you're doing online and what you do with Tiger Monkey Dragon?
They can go to tigermonkeydragon.com.
Yep, as it sounds.
Yeah, and if you want to get in touch with me, you can just hit the contact Mark link and that'll email me. You can get my email address off the website.
Yeah.
You could do something weird and sneak around and find out my personal information. But I think the website is probably a better.
That's probably the safest
probably the
way
best,
forward.
Best way to go. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark, for coming in today.
Well, thank you
chatting.
For having me. This was delightful.
Same here. You can hear more episodes of Vermont Favorites or subscribe to the podcast at imadeitup.com. If you're listening on the air, you can listen to WBTV at 993wbtv.org. And if you're streaming online, you can listen to us around Burlington and the surrounding towns at 99.3 FM. Information on upcoming guests is available at the Vermont Favorites Facebook page. Vermont Favorites is a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington. I'm Adam Rabin. Thank you for listening. Take care.